This hour on Behind the Headlines, John Swallow has stepped down as Utah's Attorney General, and a half dozen Republicans have thrown their hats into the ring. Who will emerge as the top three contenders to fill the post? And is Swallow out of the woods? In other news, education, air quality, transportation, tourism, and prisons all win in Governor Herbert's budget priorities, but will Utah lawmakers agree? And same-sex marriage proponents make their case, arguing that Utah's one-man, one-woman marriage amendment violates the federal constitution. How will the Supreme Court's defense of marriage or DOMA ruling figure into the Utah case? Plus, Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. All that and your calls. What news stories are on your mind this week? Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a week in review show, Utah style. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, life after John Swallow's resignation, same-sex marriage goes to court, and a first glimpse at Utah's budget 2015. All that plus Tribune columnist Robert Kirby later in the show. And you can join us if you like. What do you want to know about the challenge to Utah's Amendment 3? Who do you think will be Utah's next Attorney General? And what other local news stories are on your mind this week? You can send your questions and comments along to the hashtag UTReview on Twitter and Google+. Also submit comments at sltrib.com or call us. 801-355-TALK is the number. That's 801-355-8255. On today's panel, Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, who covers state government. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Justice reporter Brooke Adams is also with us. Brooke, great to have you back.
Thank you.
And the man who hasn't missed a deadline in, what, over two decades?
That's right.
Columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
Again, if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Put your comments in the comment section at sltrib.com or the hashtag UTReview on Twitter and Google+. Let's start with John Swallow, as we have for the last few weeks. Robert Gerke, now that Swallow has stepped aside, the question everyone wants to know is who will be the next attorney general, and maybe you can run down the contenders for us.
Right. Yeah, because I don't really know yet. We'll find out next a week from Saturday. The state central committee is going to be meeting and deciding which of the six people who filed so far is going to – they send three names to the governor, the top three vote getters at that committee meeting. So far, six have filed. As I said, the list could grow. The deadline's not until 5 o'clock today, so – right now, you've got Sean Reyes, who was the who lost to Swallow in a primary last year.
Tell us a bit about him. He's a lawyer.
He's an attorney. He's been heavily involved in some of the sort of the Hispanic bar and some he's represented some these gold exchange companies and so forth. But yeah, he lost to Swallow in a primary last year, and he's going to be back. Brent Ward, who's a career federal prosecutor. Happens to be, until this week, the prosecutor in the Jeremy Johnson case. Jeremy Johnson, obviously one of the people who've caused John Swallow some of the headaches that he's experienced over the last several months, alleging some impropriety. You've got Michelle Mumford, who's an associate dean of admissions at BYU and a former white-collar litigator out of New York.
And she's got some connections.
She's got some connections as well. Her husband is an attorney who's representing Mark Jensen, who's another one of Swallow's accusers, representing Scott Levitt, who's Jeremy Johnson's business partner, and representing Rick Kerber, who was also accused of some white-collar fraud here in the state. You have Scott Burns, who's a former Iron County attorney and drug czar during the Bush administration. You've got now I get down the list and I get lost where we've gone. But
Scott Burns is just returning to
Scott
Utah.
Burns has been in Washington D.C. Although he's maintained his residency here and he's voted here in the past election, so he's eligible to compete for that. You got Michael Wilkins, who's a former Supreme Court justice, and he's kind of taking an interesting tact in saying that he's only going to be a caretaker. This has kind of turned into a debate in some Republican circles about whether they need somebody who's going to take the office. Whoever takes the office is going to have to run for election again in 2014 and then again in 2016 when Swallow's term would have been up. So what Judge Wilkins is saying is that he's only going to serve until 2014. And then hand off the reins to whoever wins then, because what his point is that you need somebody in there who's focused on straightening out any issues that are that they have in the office, and not you know, not being out raising money and preparing for your next election. So, and then the last one who's filed so far is Brett Rawson, who he's representative of Fraternal Order of Police. He's a reserve police officer in the Bountiful Police Department, and he also happens to be on the legal team that's defending Mark Jensen, who again has accused Swallow of, his words were, extorting gifts and favors from him. So it's interesting that you have these people that have different ties to some of the accusers in certain ways, and those are issues that have been discussed in Republican circles and elsewhere as this thing has gone forward. I also anticipate you'll see State Representative Dan McKay get into the race by the filing deadline, and there could be others as well.
Filing deadline, Paul Raleigh, 5 o'clock today. It's not too late.
Yeah.
You're gonna throw your hat in the ring.
Paul? I think you have to be an attorney, don't you?
Oh, all right, okay. Yeah. other contenders, late filers? Do you think, Paul? Are you hearing anything?
Well, we had a story about, Brian Tarbert talking about running. He'd be an interesting choice. He's someone in the AG's office who's pretty untainted, and he's got a pretty impressive resume. He was the general of the National Guard here in Utah. And, I think he could be someone that I think the Republicans and Governor Herbert might want to take a look at. There's been rumors over the past few weeks, although he hasn't filed, of Morgan Philpott, putting his name in, but that hasn't happened yet, and we'll see.
Okay. Are you hearing anyone else?
I think Morgan Philpott's name I hear fairly frequently. Some people have tossed around Enid Bickelson's name, former Enid Green. I don't think she's necessarily interested in it. I think Tarbert has decided to that it's not something he's going to pursue. So the field probably won't grow much. Like I said, I think you'll see Dan McKay. You may see Morgan Philpott, or you may see somebody else get in as well.
Philpott's kind of an interesting choice. I seem to recall in the dark recesses of my memory that he challenged Governor Herbert.
Yeah, he's a favorite of the conservative wing of the party. He's a former state legislator. He's run for Congress. He's run for governor. And so he's got a following, and he's got some support among the delegates if he decides something he wants to pursue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so 5 o'clock is the filing deadline, and then Republican Central Committee meets
right.
When?
It's a week from Saturday on December 14th. They'll meet. The way it works is the State Central Committee, this group of about, depending on how many show up, it'll be about 150 to 180. People who are elected locally, precinct chairs, and so forth. They'll vote. The top three vote getters, their names will go to Governor Herbert, and he'll pick whichever one of those three he chooses. Doesn't have to necessarily be the top vote getter. It doesn't have to. And I talked to the governor a little bit this week about sort of his philosophy in doing this, and he's said that he's going to pick the person he thinks is best capable of setting the office straight, riding the ship, I think is how he phrased it. And so he's gonna exercise his best judgment, I guess, in that regard. And I asked him a little bit about this idea of the caretaker. You know, do we want somebody in there who's just going to be a temporary problem solver? And again, he just goes back to the concept that the issues in the office need to be addressed, and whoever he thinks is best capable of addressing those issues, he'll choose that person. So,
Paul Raleigh. So this is a statewide elected office. There will be 3 years left for this person to really make a difference. Are you surprised at all that there are only like five or six people who want this job?
Well, there are. Whoever is selected by the governor has a year, and then there's a special election.
Oh, I see.
In 2014.
But still a year, really?
Yeah. And then except for Judge Wilkins, whoever's appointed will probably run again, run for the seat outright in 2014. There are some people that I've heard about and talked to who have decided. who would like to be AG, but they would rather wait until 2014 and run then rather than go through the process now. One person who's expressed interest over several times for that job is John Valentine, Senator Valentine from Orrin. He won't throw his hat in the ring now, but he might run in 2014.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, Senator Valentine was pretty clear that he doesn't like the idea of having to run again in 2014 and then again in 2016. And he thinks that would be too much of a distraction to be out trying to raise the money and build the network you need to run in a statewide election. So,
and it's a minefield because of the Swallow issues surrounding fundraising. I mean, I think everybody's going to be watching, focusing on this race.
Right. And not only that, he says you can't go in there with your hands tied behind your back. You can't be afraid that if you fire somebody or if you dramatically change the office, that there's going to be a big backlash and it's going to hurt you electorally. You know, you've got to be able to do those things without having to worry about the consequences of it. The other thing I've heard from a few people is are we paying the attorney general enough? Because, I mean, while for Paul and Brooke and I think $104,000 a year is a pretty healthy salary.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good to us. I think for practicing attorneys out there, you know, especially experienced, you know, senior attorneys out there, it's going to be a big step down, and they'd have to look long and hard about whether their finances are in such a position that that they can afford to do that. I mean, we saw recently Greg Bell, the lieutenant governor, decided he had to leave office because he couldn't juggle his finances anymore on the salary he was getting, which was the same as what the attorney general gets. So,
you know, that salary issue's been around for a long time, and a lot of assistant attorney generals make more than the attorney general. A lot of his employees, because his salary is statutorily set. But I mean, I've written stories in the past about the quality of the attorneys general we've had over the past 20, 30 years, and just about every one of them has had some kind of problem, either minor scandals or competency issues. The one who probably escaped all of that most was Jan Graham. A lot of people have said that she's probably maybe the best attorney general we've had in the last 25 or 30 years. Bud Scruggs, who was the former chief of staff of Governor Norm Bangor and kind of an amateur comedian, responded to that by saying that's like saying you're the tallest building in Tooele. But I mean, the salary issue is a real question because it does raise the question of whether or not you're going to get the best people who want to run for that job, because, you know, a good attorney is going to make a lot more money than that in the private sector.
Is the question of appointing the attorney general going to come up again in the session, Paul? I mean, are you hearing from your political sources that, you know, this whole Swallow thing, this mess could be solved in this way?
I don't think it'll go far. I know that there are people who are pushing that. I believe Troy Rawlings, the Davis County attorney, who is one of the county attorneys investigating Swallow and Shurtleff, still, I believe he said that maybe it should be a nonpartisan position, and you run as a nonpartisan. But I don't think anybody in the legislature is going to be willing to make too big of a change on that anytime soon.
Senator Wyler, who is an attorney himself, is sponsoring it's a constitutional amendment that would have to get 2/3 of the vote in both chambers and then be approved to go on the 2014 ballot, and if it's approved, would take effect in 2016. He's favoring having the legislature appoint the attorney general. Five states have the governor appoint the attorney general. So it's something that's being discussed. As Paul said, I think there might be some resistance to it. It's hard for legislators to decide that they want to take a vote away from the people. And so I think there's a political liability in that. So it's, we'll see how far it gets. Two-thirds is a tough barrier for anything, and it's designed to be tough, and so it's gonna, but it'll be something that's discussed at least during the upcoming session.
We only have a couple of minutes before we need to take a break, but ongoing investigation. Swallow is not entirely gone yet. Robert, what's left to settle?
Well, so on Saturday, the House Investigative Committee that was created to investigate him while he was in office is going to meet, and they're going to be discussing how they wrap up their investigation, because their only avenue, if they found wrongdoing, would have been to recommend, or they weren't going to recommend, but would have been for the House to impeach Swallow. With him having resigned, that's off the table now. So the House investigation, which has already spent over $1.5 million, has decided that they're going to wrap things up. They're going to meet tomorrow to discuss how to do that, and they'll issue a report in the coming weeks. It'll probably be a little while for them to get that completed. The county attorneys, working with the FBI and state investigators, are continuing their investigation into potential criminal charges. The lieutenant governor's investigation obviously wrapped up, and they issued their report. It came out the day after Swallow resigned, and they found that there were some election violations there. There's also a Utah bar complaint. We don't really know where that is, because they do their work in very, very much a secretive environment. And so those are the ones that are still pending out there.
Paul Worrally, final word. When are we going to stop talking about this? Is it months from now, a year from now? Are we in the clear?
I think it's going to resonate through 2014. I think the Democrats will keep it alive. They're going to make they wanted the election to be thrown out. They felt that when the lieutenant governor found that or his investigator found that Swallow violated election law, they felt that should be the whole election should have been thrown out and we have another election. And they felt that we should have an election now, rather than have the governor appoint an attorney general. And I think they're going to make the case throughout 2014 that Swallow is a good example of why people need to pay more attention to the candidates rather than just the party they represent.
Okay, we'll keep talking about it then. Tribune columnist Paul Worrally, reporters Robert Gerke and Brooke Adams with me, talking about the week's top local stories here on Behind the Headlines. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or you can put your comments in the comments section at sltrib.com. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, a review of the week's top local stories. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Brooke Adams, and columnist Paul Worrally, talking about the top stories this week. And we are taking your calls. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. What stories are on your mind this week? You can also put comments and questions on our website, sltrib.com, or send them to the hashtag UTReview on Twitter and Google+. Big case heard this week in federal district court. Brooke Adams, you were there. A federal judge heard oral arguments in a case that's challenging Utah's One Man, One Woman Amendment 3. Who are the plaintiffs, and what are they arguing?
The plaintiffs are three couples, Derek and Moody Sabidi, Kate Call and Karen Archer, and Cody Partridge and Lori Wood. Two of the couples, the two men and Lori and Cody, are in long-term relationships. Kate and Karen are actually married in Iowa, went to Iowa to get married and returned here to Utah to live. So they're the plaintiffs, and they are arguing that the state's law, that Amendment 3 that was added to the state constitution in 2004 by voters, discriminates against them and holds them out for unfair treatment. So both sides are using the recent Supreme Court ruling to bolster their arguments, and we'll see where it goes.
Again, folks may recall the Supreme Court struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. It's called DOMA this summer. So the plaintiff's argument on what that ruling did? I mean, how does that fit into the Utah picture?
Yeah, well, they're saying that with DOMA, under DOMA, that the state's law is holding them out to discrimination and unequal protection under the law. And so just based on that decision that Utah's law is a non-starter. It has to go. The states, on the other hand, are using that ruling to say it upholds the right of states to decide and regulate who can marry. So, you know, the judge, as he listened to their argument, said, well, I don't know that you can draw out of the ruling quite as clearly these lines each of you are trying to make. So he has quite a task before him to decide where to go with that outcome.
What was the atmosphere like in the courtroom?
It was packed. There were a lot of people, you know, I think on the side of the plaintiffs there listening. There were also a couple of federal judges listening into the arguments, and everybody was very respectful, very intently listening as the discussion. And it was like sitting in on a historic moment. Peggy Tomczyk, the attorney for the plaintiffs, really gave kind of a rousing 90-minute long argument to the judge that just felt historic, actually, in what she was trying to argue. So it was, you know, really kind of a interesting moment to be in a courtroom.
And it is a landmark moment. I mean, a lot of people are watching this nationally, since this would be the first federal judge to decide a state's marriage law since the DOMA ruling.
Yeah, there was kind of a funny moment in court as that issue came up. The judge asked, well, am I going to be the first federal judge to have to rule after DOMA? And Peggy Tomczyk, the plaintiff's attorney, said, yes, you will be. Congratulations, Your Honor. And everybody laughed. I don't think the judge is finding that a laughing moment, really. He's you know, going to be under a lot of scrutiny. One thing I might say interesting, he had vowed that he would rule with deliberate speed, is what he said, and he would try to do that before the next scheduled court hearing, which is January 7th. Mm. So he's on a very quick track to make a decision here. Both sides have asked for summary judgment, which is asking him to decide that the facts they've laid out and the points that they've made don't require this to go to trial. And in fact, in, you know, dozens and dozens of cases over decades that have dealt with same-sex issues, same-sex marriage, they usually are decided on summary judgment. Hmm. So it's likely that he will issue a ruling for one side or the other. There won't be a trial, and that once whoever's the loser is obviously likely to appeal.
That's a pretty ambitious schedule for a federal district judge, Robert Shelby. He's been on the job for like just over a year, and he's got this big case.
Yeah, I think he feels that way.
I mean, Paul, in the political circles that you are part of, what are people saying about this case?
Well, I don't know what to, if I have much to add from what Brooke just said. She's been covering the story. If you want to talk about it politically, you know, Utah was one of, I believe, 13 states that had that constitutional amendment on the ballot to define marriage. And it was when George W. Bush was running for re-election. Against John Kerry, and there is a lot of, there's some evidence and a lot of feeling that it was all a political maneuver orchestrated by Karl Rove, who was, the Bush's political guru, to get this sort of thing on state ballots to bring out the conservatives and make them more passionate to come out and vote. And I think that there's something to that. And so there's a political taint, I think, to this whole thing. And I think most observers believe that as time goes on, there's going to be more and more tolerance toward gay marriage. I mean, the younger population, they really don't see that as an issue. I wouldn't even be surprised, maybe in another 10, 15, 20 years, you see that revisited on the Utah ballot. But I don't know. We live in Salt Lake City. It was a pretty gay-friendly city. We also live in Utah, which is, the rest of the state is probably takes almost an opposite view. So we'll just have to see.
But I mean, voters approved Amendment 3. So what are policymakers, state lawmakers, I mean, are they sort of shaking in their boots, Robert?
Well, I think as Paul mentioned, there's been some time pass and some opinions have changed about same-sex unions and civil unions, I guess. We saw Governor Huntsman, when he was still governor, take a position in favor of it, and he's even gone further, I think, since then. I think one of the things, though, given the tight time frames that Brooke discussed on this, it will be on the agenda during the upcoming legislative session. I mean, there are legislators up there who are adamant that this Amendment 3 is not only constitutional, but the principle of it, that marriage should be between a man and a woman, is absolutely correct. So they're not going to allow this to kind of go quietly into the night, you know. So I think given that this court ruling will be coming, that there will be at least the prospect of an appeal and that it'll be working its way through the courts, I would expect you'll see the legislature, some of the conservative legislators, step up and try to shore up the or reinforce the support of the state for the Amendment 3.
Brooke, I imagine that there's a certainty, no matter which way Shelby rules, it will be appealed, right?
Oh, yeah. I think that's clear. Both sides will take the challenge on. I want to follow up something Paul said about shifting public opinion. Even the state notes that in their filings in the court that since the mid-1990s, support for same-sex marriage has doubled. So, you know, they're tracking this and referencing this shifting support and change in public opinion. And I think that's true in Utah, too. There is a poll by Utah Data Points. They put out some data about a year ago that said even in Utah that 43% of Utah voters now support civil unions. So, you know, public opinion is really shifting on this.
So what is the state's defense? I mean, what is their strategy to get across?
Well, they say, A, that it's a state's right to decide who can marry. And yes, that may, they say, make some people unhappy, but that's the effect of laws, and the majority will. And, you know, we're sorry that people feel discriminated against, but that's where we fall on this issue. They hold out responsible procreation and, you know,
what does that mean?
Married couples having children as the primary purpose behind the law, and also a gold standard of having a married man and woman raise children. That's the best environment for children to be raised in. You know, that led to some interesting questions from the judge during the hearing. He said, well, if it's all about procreation, does that mean, for example, a postmenopausal woman in Utah could not get a marriage license? Are you going to take steps to bar them? Are you going to have fertility tests for couples before they can get a marriage license? And, you know, the plaintiffs point out, in fact, that same-sex couples in Utah are raising children, many of them. There are nearly 3,000 children being raised in same-sex households here in Utah. I think it's the highest in the country.
What tough questions did Shelby have for the plaintiff's attorney, Peggy Thompson?
You know, he pushed her about what heightened standard, what review standard should be used in the case. He challenged her about whether states do have the right to decide this issue. You know, those were generally it. And so.
Okay. We're speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brooke Adams and Robert Gerke, also with us columnist Paul Raleigh. And we're taking your calls at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Let's go to the phones. And Tim is calling us from Salt Lake City. Tim, you've been patiently waiting. Thank you so much for the time. What's your question?
I want to shout out to KCPW and you, Jennifer, JC, Jennifer Pierce, and the whole bunch of the reporters there, of whom one is a co-conspirator, unindicted, I might add, of mine, Paul.
okay.
I was just thinking that when we were talking about former Attorney General Swallow, shirtless, and all the smudges, And the foul air, couldn't the governor at least make some kind of a statement and clean the air, at least in this way, if not an actually measurable way, by allowing Judge Wilkins to serve as a caregiver?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Tim, I think a lot of people are making that argument. How popular is that sentiment, Robert?
Well, from a principled standpoint, it probably has some legs. But politically, it is a little problematic because there's a huge advantage to being an incumbent when you're running in 2014. And the Republicans want that advantage, you know, especially given the fact that Democrats are, as Paul said, probably going to be using this Swallow saga as a talking point or to run a campaign on in 2014. So the advantage of having an incumbent in there who's going to be seeking the office again is significant. And I think the Republicans, these Republicans who are going to be making the choices are politically active and politically astute and recognize that as well. But yeah, there's a principled argument to be made, as we talked about Senator Valentine's argument, Judge Wilkins' argument, and Brent Ward's making an interesting argument too, that he said, well, I'm not going to rule out running again, but I'm not going to start campaigning. I'm not going to start raising money until October, a month before the election. If I lose in the primary, so be it. But I'm going to be focused for that period of time up until October on running the office.
Tim, I mean, is that what is so appealing to you? Is that somebody?
Oh, I'm just sick of the nastiness and the political air, the air we breathe, and a lot of other things. I was just thinking of the person who ran against John Swallow from Ogden, Smith, right?
D. Smith, the Democrat, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. His qualifications were almost untarnished.
Well, the Democrats briefly made the argument that they should have a special election so that a Democrat could run, because they argued that if the election should be voided because of the violations of campaign law, then nobody won the election and there nobody has a claim to the seat. By deciding not to pursue that, the avenue of voiding the election, the lieutenant governor's office sort of took that off the table. Democrats have gotten behind. Senator DeBacchus, the chairman of the Democratic Party, has gotten behind this idea of a caretaker. So we'll see what the delegates of the state Republican State Central Committee decide they want.
Well, there's probably no more interesting place to live than Utah.
Tim, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-825. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Also with me, Robert Gerke, Brooke Adams, and Paul Raleigh. We're talking about the week's top headlines. And if you've got something to say, 801-355-TALK is our number, or go online, sltrib.com. Put your comments in the comment section there. We're monitoring that as well. I want to switch gears a little bit and get to the budget, because it can be a dry topic, but it seems to affect every one of us in this room and elsewhere. Governor Herbert, of course, released his plan this week. The big winner is education. Robert, no surprise there, I guess.
Not really. I mean, public opinion polls have shown that education is most voters' top priority, and the governor for several years has said it's his top priority as well. So, and there's also the fact that the growth in the budget has predominantly been in the income tax, and constitutionally the income tax has to go to education. So that was sort of a given that was going to grow more. But he's looking for an increase in per pupil spending about $100 per student. It's about $64 million, I believe, maybe $62. And so that, you know, Utah continues to be last in the nation in its per pupil spending, and it will, you know, bring the state up a little bit, probably to about where it was in 2008. The number actually went down during the recession. So, you know, but he's touting this as a big victory for public education. His goal is this: getting 66% of Utahns to have a post high school degree by 2020, and he says this is going to be a step put them on the path to reaching that goal. It's a lofty goal because they've got a long ways to go, and it's not a lot of time to do it.
Mm-hmm. Is this something educators, the UEA, can get behind, Paul Raleigh?
Well, I think they'd like to see more. I mean, every governor in my memory has said education is their number one priority, and there's always been a lot of lip service given to it. Whether $100 per pupil is enough, I don't think that the UEA or Robert Story pointed out that I believe in the last budget the legislature went down about can't remember what the figure was.
I
but,
can't remember what the numbers
but,
were.
But, you know, you've got the legislature will come up with a final budget, and whether they give the governor as much as he's asking for, they usually don't. I believe still there's a large public anti-public education sentiment at least in factions in the legislature, and they're constantly looking at ways to send money, privatize education in with vendors in different programs, and that sort of thing. So we'll see how it plays in the legislature. You know, in the 1980s, you know, Robert pointed out that constitutionally our income tax goes to education. In the 1980s, the legislature amended the Constitution to include higher education. Before that, it just went to public income tax was required to go just to public education. They made it both public and higher education, which now higher education, public education is sharing that pot, which frees up other taxes to go to, favorite legislative projects like roads and things like that, so prisons. Mm. We'll see how it plays out, but I'm not optimistic that the legislature will give the governor everything he wants as far as education goes.
Mm-hmm.
The governor, Speaker Lockhart said that, you know, the governor obviously shares the value that the legislators share, which is education is the top priority. They may approach it differently. I think that kind of goes to what Paul is saying. There has been this tendency to not put as much into the lump sum per pupil spending and put more into things like technology programs and computer software and things like that, some of which, as Paul pointed out, has gone to particular vendors. There will be a lot of money going to education. The governor recommended $261 million all told. That includes a building up at Weber State and all the higher education money. And then you've got things like, you've got prisons and roads and he recommended a pay raise for employees of about 1.25%. One of the things that you asked about the UEA and its feelings on the education money that they proposed, they were actually seeking 4% because they said by the time you take out the increase in Social Security and retirement that they're going to have to pay, that takes 1% of the 2.5% out. And then you can't factor in inflation. They're basically just holding steady with the cost of living increase in inflation. So, they're going to push for more. Will they get it? Given the scarcity of money up at the legislature, it seems unlikely that they'll get much more than that. But they're going to push for it.
Mm-hmm. Brooke,
Robert, yeah, talk a little bit about what he's done with the prison project because he is listening to the prison relocation committee,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there's this discussion that Brooke's been covering about whether to relocate the Draper Prison, and it sits on a pretty attractive plot of land down in Draper where, people would like to expand and build houses and so forth. He's proposed setting aside $3.5 million. So if this committee that's studying whether to move the prison comes to a conclusion, and Brooke probably knows more about the timeline for their decision making, but if they come to a conclusion, they have money there to begin the planning and for that move. It's sort of a look ahead. I mean, the PRADA board, the prison relocation board that's looking at it, has kind of slowed things down a little bit. And the governor said he supported that idea, although there was some legislators last month who were not happy. They feel like it was taking too long and that, property values are going to go up. The state's going to be paying more for this. They're going to be paying more for construction and it needs to move quicker. That's what the legislators felt like. The governor's satisfied with the slower time frame and he's, looking ahead to if they make a decision, there will be some money there to begin action on that.
He set aside some money to expand at Gunnison, right? That's one thing the product committee really was pushing for.
They're going to expand Gunnison, and I'm trying to remember exactly how many beds it was. I think it was like 194 beds, but also set aside some money to put more state prison inmates into jails,
which will make
jails.
The counties happy.
They always love that. There was this in the mid 90s. There was this big building boom where the counties were going out building these huge jails, sort of state-of-the-art facilities, thinking that they could then go to the state and put state prison inmates in their county jails and make money, fill their beds and make money that way. And it kind of worked, but, you know, when the money starts drying up, the state starts giving them less, and they've had to, you know, fight for that back and forth. I mean, some of these state county jails, I mean, they could incarcerate one out of every, I think, seven people in the county. I mean, they're much bigger than they need, and they were built sort of with that in mind. So.
One item that was noticeably absent in the budget is the decision whether or not to expand Medicaid, which is that health coverage to the poor. Under Obamacare, the number of Utahns qualifying for Medicaid is expected to jump. So what's the governor's hang-up?
Yeah, well, they were anticipating, actually, that Medicaid enrollment was not going to grow as fast as they thought over the past year. But because of the Obamacare mandates, they have to cover more people. They are expecting rolls to grow by about 40,000 next year, by the end of the 2015 fiscal year. So there's also this question that the governor didn't address of whether to do the Medicaid expansion, which would cover people up to 138% of poverty level. It's about 123,000 Utahns that would be covered. The federal government would pay for that, though. So the governor says whether we take that or not in the immediate budget year, it doesn't have any impact on the budget. It's all covered by the federal government, presumably. So he's going, and he says he's not going to be rushed into making a decision. Now, most other states, I think almost all of the other states, have already decided one way or the other. The governor says he's going to work with the legislature and probably come to some conclusion before the start of the session, which is about 6 weeks away. And you know, what I'm hearing is that there's going to be some sort of hybrid model, basically, that they're going to try to get be granted some variance from the federal government that Utah can do sort of what it wants and cover a portion of these people and maybe do something else with some of the others. And it's going to be, but you know, we're going to have to wait and see what he does there. But it wasn't.
This is totally going to consume your life in the next couple of
Kristen
months.
Kristen Stewart can handle it. But yeah, it's going to be time consuming. And it's a big decision because the governor says, you know, down the road, the federal payments start going down from 100% down to 90%. And there's going to be a state commitment down the road to cover some of these people. And so he's going to be cautious about that.
We're taking your questions on Twitter at UT Review. This coming in from Kyle. Also, the AG office isn't able to hire even entry-level attorneys due to the low-paying job. It's an issue that we spoke about earlier on who will replace the Utah Attorney General. We're taking your calls as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporters Robert Gerke and Brooke Adams, along with columnist Paul Raleigh, talking about the big local stories this week. What's on your mind? We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me in studio, Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brooke Adams and Robert Gerke, along with columnist Paul Raleigh. And we're taking your calls. 801-355-TALK is the number. 801-355-8255. Kind of want to do a little wrap-up of stories that maybe didn't get the attention that you think we're going to hear more of in the future, kind of rapid fire style. Paul Raleigh, what's your pick?
The U.S. Supreme Court recently declined to hear a case out of New York that concerned taxing sales tax on remote sales, internet sales.
Overstock.com was one of the plaintiffs.
Yeah, Overstock.com is in the middle of all this. It's become a very contentious issue. The fact that the Supreme Court's not taking it up and letting the states pretty much, decide. Several states have passed laws. Everybody says that it's up. Congress is going to be the one that needs to pass the law, and the U.S. Senate has passed a law that would set up a sales tax on remote sales consistently throughout the country. The House hasn't taken it up yet, and I think there are a lot of politics involved in that.
How is Utah's delegation chiming in?
Utah, the last 2 years, is the only state in the nation over the last 2 years that passed resolutions urging Congress to pass a remote sales tax bill. The interesting thing about that is Utah is also the only state whose two senators, both senators, voted against the federal law in the Senate. Now, my understanding is that Orrin Hatch is softening on that and is willing to do something with some tweaks. I'm not sure about Lee, but in our House delegation, they're pretty much on board with doing something. It would bring the estimate is it would bring in at least $180 million in new revenue into the state.
Okay, internet sales taxes. That's the story we're going to hear about more. Okay, Robert Gerke.
Well, I think one that Paul wrote about and I think is going to get a lot more traction is Senator Bramble is going to be sponsoring a bill that would revise the way that Utahns choose their delegates. There's obviously the Count My Vote movement that wants to go to direct primaries. There's a pushback against that by some groups that want to preserve the current caucus and convention system. Senator Bramble is proposing sort of a middle path that I think is getting a little bit of traction up at the legislature right now, even though it's not been broadly discussed. I think that's going to be a significant one. I think the other thing that we'll probably talk about a lot during the upcoming legislative session, and it probably goes a little bit to what Brooke talked about earlier, is the anti-discrimination ordinance that it has gotten some attention already, but Senator Urquhart is gearing up for a big fight on that one this year.
Okay, keep your antenna up for those. Brooke?
Okay, well, I'm not going to – this is a feel-good story. This is a story you have to go pick up the paper or hop online to read today because it's just going to warm your heart. It's about Doug Holliday, who has a terminal illness, and this is probably his last Christmas. He spent all day Thursday out in front of a Walmart ringing the bell for the Salvation Army and hoping to fill three kettles full of money. And it's just a wonderful story by Matt Piper. And you've got to read it to feel good about this guy and you know, his thoughts as he's looking at his last Christmas probably. He's a longtime volunteer for the Salvation Army. He had a hard time earlier in his life, struggled with addiction and different problems. But,
and according to the story, people responded quite warmly yesterday, brought out a heater for him and some blankets, sort of cheering him on.
Yeah, it's really just a really touching story. So you've got to get online and read about it.
Okay, we will leave it there. My pick for the story that will get more coverage, sports reporter Leah Wadreska reported this week that the pressure to drop the Ute name at the University of Utah is building. Tribal leaders are asking for tuition waivers for their students. Students up there say, forget it. You know, it's offensive to us to see the drum and feather symbol. Gerke, you've posted that symbol on your Facebook page.
As a fan,
how do you feel about it?
Well, I'm a longtime Utah fan, and I guess, you know, it's Paul is as well, right?
Oh, I bleed deep crimson. Yeah,
yeah.
So can you be something other than a Ute?
I don't know. Maybe the students think so, but I don't think most of the alumni do. I mean, I can't imagine me rooting for a different name, other than the Utes.
Okay, wrap your head around that one. We're going to hear that story, more of it. Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brooke Adams, Robert Gerke, columnist Paul Raleigh, thank you all very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Stay warm.
We're going to wrap up this hour with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and this week we talk about lessons he learned on the Tavaputs Ranch.
Tavaputs Ranch, that's like my favorite place in the whole world. I found it because they had invited me up to go on a cattle drive with them. And I don't particularly like cows. It's a childhood thing. I'm actually afraid of them. What some people feel about spiders, I feel about cows. So I went, and it turned out to be this beautiful place up on West Tavaputs Plateau, one of the most isolated places in Utah, where they have a working ranch. Butch and Jeannie Jensen own it, and they run this ranch / hunting preserve or lodge. And they invite a few people up every year. And I fell in love with it. It's quiet, it's high, and it goes on forever.
You went up there with a friend, Tate Jensen. Describe this man to us.
Actually, Tate is the Butch and Jeannie's son. And I rode with them on a series of drives, and I got to be really good friends with the family. And Tate was just this happy-go-lucky cowboy who had this amazing philosophy about life, and that you just take it as it comes. And we were riding in the rain one time, and everybody was complaining about it. And he says, well, it can't last forever, so just ride it out. And that's pretty good philosophy to go through life.
I actually want you to read that section of your column. This was published a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was published in September 2011. Riding along in the slop of mud, manure, ice, and torn leaves, I complained at length about cows, the weather, and the grudge Mother Nature seemed to bear us. Tate looked over at me. On his wet face was the same easygoing expression he wore when the sun was shining on it 10 minutes ago. It can't last forever, he said. He had a point. I'd never seen weather that lasted forever. 5 minutes later, the sun was out. It was the first of many things I learned while pushing cows with Tate, including never feed another man's working dog, you'll always lose a fight with a mule, and bear poop is a sign that it's time to go the hell somewhere else.
Good lessons.
Good
for
lessons,
life.
You bet.
Sadly, this column takes a tragic turn. Yes. Tell us what happened to Tate.
Tate was murdered in Price later that year. And the column was actually written about Tate and the philosophy that he had and the things that he left with me. He was murdered in Price in circumstances that are really still too bizarre to contemplate. And it shocked everybody who knew him. Because he was one of those kind of larger-than-life characters because he was so easygoing. And I had to say something about it, and so I sat down and I wrote this column. And I hope it worked for the family. I know that it helped me get through it a little bit. And I still go up there every year, and he's buried on the West Tavaputs right there in the aspens. And I always stop by and say hello to him. And life comes to a close before we're ready.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and you can read his columns at sltrib.com. Hear him each week here on Behind the Headlines. That's it for Behind the Headlines, the show produced by the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.